Let's look at Nahum chapter 2. That's where we're picking up the book of Nahum. The theme of Nahum I don't have any control here. The theme of Nahum, so click on the screen. You know what to do. You guys are the pros back there. There we go. The theme of Nahum is comfort in judgment. The book is all about the destruction of Nineveh. Now, that doesn't sound very comforting, unless the Ninevites want to destroy you. Well, then it could be kind of comforting. And that's where this comfort comes, is because the people that are trying to destroy Israel, God's going to deal with them. Nahum's name actually means comfort, and so it is kind of, it's all kind of tied together. We call, this book is about comfort through judgment. We're going to actually start in chapter 1, verse 15. That's where we left off last week. And just as a note, if you have access to the internet, to the worldwide web or not stuff on your device, if you go to the church website, calvaryfullerton.org, in the right corner of the menu bar, there's a thing that says download notes, service notes. That's today's notes. That's always whatever service is current. If you click on that thing, it will download to you as if I had a handout that you could fill in the blanks, but you'll download it on your phone or your tablet or whatever, and it'll be up until the next week. So, Nahum chapter, actually starting in chapter 1, verse 15. This is where we left off last week, and I did this on purpose. Verse 15, chapter 1, behold, on the mountains, the feet of him who brings good tidings, who proclaims peace. O Judah, keep your appointed feasts, perform your vows, for the wicked one shall no more pass through you. He is utterly cut off. Now, talks about the feet of him who brings good tidings. In the ancient days, there was no television. A shock. Aren't you glad you're living today? Huh? Junior hires, aren't you glad you live today and not in ancient days? I mean, no television, no internet, no phones, no iPods, not even, for those of you older like me, no newspapers. I mean, I love my newspaper in the morning, only the sports section, though. I my coffee, I watch MLB channel, and I read the sports section. That's like my favorite thing to do in the morning. But there's no newspapers even. People got their news from far-off places, from messengers, often traveling on foot. That's how you found out. That's how one day the people in Jerusalem would find out what was going on in Nineveh. It's because a messenger would show up. On the mountains, the feet of him who brings glad tidings. And you know what? Nahum is that messenger. This book is the message. And what's really fascinating is that he's giving it 40 years early. He's writing at least 40 years before these things will take place. His timing's a little bit off. I'm usually late to things. Nahum is 40 years early. Isn't that amazing? Chapter 2. Chapters 2 and 3 are about an event in history known as the Battle of Nineveh. And starting in chapter 2, we will get the peek into this future good news through Nahum's eyes. In 645 BC, this is about the time that Nahum is writing. At least this is the latest what we covered last week, the possibility of when he wrote this, 645 BC. About 19 years from this point, a war will break out between Assyria and Babylon. And the Babylonians will attack, the Syrians will counterattack, there'll be fighting back and forth. Finally, the Babylonians will ally with the Medes and about four or five other nations. They get a big alliance going, and they attack the Assyrians, and that's when things start happening. And in 612 BC, Nineveh falls. What we're going to read right now in chapters 2 and 3 are what took place in 612 BC, the fall of Nineveh, the culmination, the battle of Nineveh. So chapter 2, verse 1. He who scatters has come up before your face. Man the fort, watch the road, strengthen your flanks, fortify your power mightily. This is the words being spoken in Nineveh. For the Lord will restore the excellence of Jacob like the excellence of Israel. For the emptiers have emptied them out and ruined their vine branches. Talking about how Assyria has ripped off God's people. Verse 3, the shields of his mighty men are made red. The valiant men are in scarlet. The chariots come with flaming torches in the day of his preparation, and the spears are brandished. Now he's talking about those who are attacking Nineveh, the Medes and the Babylonians. And it says their shields are what color? Red. They're red. Why are they red? Because they're covered with blood. Covered with blood. Verse 4. The chariots rage in the streets. They jostle one another in the broad roads. They seem like torches. They run like lightning. These chariots that are going to be attacking, man, they're going to be fast, like lightning. Kind of like the way some people drive. The judge fined the motorist $225 for speeding and gave him a receipt after it. Well, what am I supposed to do with this? Frame it? Snapped the driver. The judge said, no, save it. When you get three of them, you get a bike. Sorry, that's the only humor of the morning. So just save it, roll it around in the tongue, and stop applauding, okay? Verse 5. He remembers his nobles. They stumble in their walk. They make haste into their walls, and the defense is prepared. The gates of the river are open. And the palace is dissolved. It says the gates of the river are open. Now, one of the things I want to point out as we're going through these chapters, I'm going to stop at some of the events that are being predicted. And I want to bring out the prophetic aspect and what actually happened. And here, the prophecy is that the gates of the river are open. There would be a flood. Prior to this time, prior to 612 BC, there was a great king, Sennacherib, who built a dam upstream, up the river. Well, when the current enemies in 612 BC come in on the site, they shut down the dam, the reservoir starts to overflow, and then they let it loose. And the river floods. The ancient historian Diodorus, I'll quote him a few times, he writes in 20 BC, he wrote that the river had flooded and broken down part of the wall, allowing the enemy troops to eventually enter the city. This is part of what happens. Verse 7, it is decreed, she shall be led away captive, she shall be brought up, and her maidservants shall lead her as with the voice of doves beating their breasts. Though Nineveh of old was like a pool of water, nice and calm, now they flee away. Halt, halt, they cry, but no one turns back. It says, now they flee away. The prophecy is that some people would escape. Now, this is going to fly in contradiction to some other things we're going to read. But it says some people will escape. Diodorus wrote, King Sinshar Ishkun, who was the current king at the attack in 612, he sent away his three sons and two daughters with much treasure to Paphlagonia, to the governor of Katos, the most loyal of his subjects. So some people did escape, just as Nahum said they would. Verse 9, take spoil of silver, take spoil of gold. There is no end of treasure or wealth of every desirable prize. Now, the prophecy is that they would be plundering. People are going to make some bucks off of this. They're going to walk away with treasures, kind of like with, you know, what happened in Iraq. You know, people were plundering the treasures. According to the Babylonian Chronicle, great quantities of spoil from the city, beyond counting, they carried off. The city they turned into a mound and a ruin heap. There was great plundering. People came home with a few extra bucks in their pocket. Verse 10, she is empty, desolate, and waste. The heart melts, the knees shake, much pain is in every side. And all their faces are drained of color. Where is the dwelling of the lions and the feeding place of the young lions, where the lion walked, the lioness and the lion's club, and no one made them afraid? Now, the Assyrian kings had this thing for lions. They used to describe themselves as lions. And in their spare time, they went lion hunting with bows and arrows. These were amazing people. You don't want to mess with the Assyrians. But now the lions are all gone, it says verse 11. Verse 12, the lion tore in pieces enough for his cubs, killed for his lionesses, filled his caves with prey and his dens with flesh. Behold, I am against you, says the Lord of hosts. I will burn your chariots in smoke, and the sword shall devour your young lions. I will cut off your prey from the earth, and the voice of your messengers shall be heard no more. Chapter 3, verse 1. Woe to the bloody city. It is all full of lies and robbery. Its victim never departs. Nineveh was famous for how they tortured their victims. They would cut off hands. They would cut off feet, ears, noses. They'd gouge out eyes. They would tie people down. In fact, one of them, on this one down here, they would tie people down and they would slowly strip off their flesh. They're bad people, wicked people, the bloody city. Nineveh is the bloody city. Verse 3:2, the noise of a whip and the noise of rattling wheels, of galloping horses, of clattering chariots, horsemen charge with bright sword and glittering spear. There's a multitude of slain, a great number of bodies, countless corpses. They stumble over the corpses. Can't you picture all this stuff? I mean, it's just amazing the pictures that he's describing. He's describing here a multitude of slain, and the prophecy is that there would be a great massacre. Diodorus wrote, so great was the multitude of the slain that the flowing stream mingled with their blood changed its color for a considerable distance. The river turned red from all the blood of the corpses laying around. Verse 4, because of the multitudes of harlotries, of the seductive harlot, the mistress of sorceries, who sells nations through her harlotries and the families through her sorceries. This is all coming because of the mistress of sorceries. One of the chief gods of Assyria was the goddess Ishtar. I don't know how you can be both the goddess of sex and war. That kind of doesn't make sense to me, but neither do these screwy gods. She was known in Israel as Ashtoreth, as Asherah. Ishtar was all over the place. And this is why this is coming. Verse 5. Behold, I am against you, says the Lord of hosts. I will lift your skirts over your face. This harlot, this Ishtar. I will lift your skirts over your face. I will show the nations your nakedness and the kingdoms your shame. I will cast abominable filth upon you, make you vile and make you a spectacle. It shall come to pass that all who look upon you will flee from you and say, Nineveh is laid waste. Who will bemoan her? Where shall I seek comforters for you? Verse 8. Are you better than No-Ammon? That's the name of a city. Are you better than No-Ammon that was situated by the river, that had the waters around her, whose rampart was the sea, whose wall was the sea? No-Ammon. The city of Nineveh was located along the Tigris River. Jerusalem's about 550 miles away, and another 450 miles, another 1,000 miles away from Nineveh is the city called Thebes. That's the city of No-Ammon, Thebes. It's along the Nile River. It was, in that day, a large place. It had temples, statues. These are some of these are the 3D renderings that you find on Google Earth. This one palace area here, or the temple area of Thebes. Thebes, No-Ammon, it's known as Thebes. It's also known as Luxor, not the place in Las Vegas. Some of you are thinking the Luxor, because I've seen ads for that, the Luxor Hotel. But that gets their idea from this place. This is the original Luxor. Six huge temples they've uncovered at Luxor, all over the place. These things are huge. Each one is called a colossus. I think this is Ramses II. The name's like Amhotep. It sounds like the Mummy movie or something. In fact, I'm pretty sure that some of this stuff is like they filmed it like in that kind of a thing. That's Luxor. It's big. It's famous. It's huge. In fact, it was one of the, at one point, 14th century BC, that's 1300 to 1400 BC, it was the largest city in the world. Thebes was a big place, big, big place. Verse 9, it says, Ethiopia and Egypt were her strength, and it's bound, and it was boundless. Put and Lubim were your helpers. These are all nations that surrounded Thebes. It had allies everywhere. Safest place on earth. Verse 10, yet she was carried away. She went into captivity. Her young children also were dashed to pieces. At the head of every street, they cast lots for her honorable men, and all her great men were bound in chains. So what's happening here is that God's saying to Nineveh, what, you think you're greater than Thebes? You think that you can withstand something that Thebes couldn't withstand? And by the way, you want to guess who conquered Thebes? The Assyrians. Oh, they know all about it. It was Ashurbanipal, that's the name of the fellow, who was the king of Assyria at its height. He was the greatest of the kings of Assyria. He was a great warrior. He was also quite the scholar. He collected texts from all around the world. When they finally dug up Nineveh, everybody was astounded at the size of the number of clay tablets that they found. Ashurbanipal records the fall of Thebes. He writes, "This city, the whole of it, I conquered it with the help of Ashur and Ishtar." Ashur is the name of Assyria. Ishtar, this goddess thing. "Silver, gold, precious stones, all the wealth of the palace, rich cloth, precious linen, great heroes, supervising men and women, 2 obelisks of splendid electrum weighing 2,500 talents. The doors of temples I tore from their bases and carried them off to Assyria. With this weighty booty I left Thebes. Against Egypt and Cush I have lifted my spear and shown my power. With full hands I have returned to Nineveh in good health." It's just his record of having conquered Thebes. And God says to Nineveh, are you better than Noamon? You think you're not going to fall? Now, there's a little irony in the way God's saying this. Because the way God is couching, you think you're better than Noamon? Well, when you study the Assyrians' conquests, phrases, are you better than so-and-so? That's exactly the way they would threaten the nations that they would come up against. If you look at 2 Kings chapter 18 for homework, when Sennacherib at an earlier time came up against Jerusalem, he used the same kind of phraseology. He listed all of his conquests, and you think, are you any better? You think you're going to stand against us? It's kind of interesting. This is the way they would taunt a besieged city. And yet, in the end, God is the one who's really in control, not the Assyrians. Verse 11, "You also will be drunk. You will be hidden. You also will seek refuge from the enemy." Another prophecy speaks of drunkenness. Diodorus writes, "The Assyrian king distributed to his soldiers meats and liberal supplies of wine and provisions. While the whole army was thus carousing," while they're all getting drunk, "the friends of Arbaces learned from some deserters of the slackness and drunkenness which prevailed in the enemy's camp and made an unexpected attack by night." They got attacked while they were drunk. Somebody get my sword. Prophecies of drunkenness. He says also in verse 11, "You will be hidden." The city would disappear. Some parts of the city were inhabited later, but by 1500 A.D., there's no trace of Nineveh. By 1500 A.D., there's absolutely no trace of Nineveh. In fact, the early Bible, well, I shouldn't say early, the Bible critics, 1700, 1800 A.D., they would write this stuff like, Nineveh? What's Nineveh? We don't even know where Nineveh is. There is no such place. It's just a fable. The story of Jonah going to Nineveh, it's all made up. It's all made up because they couldn't find it. Well, until 1842, then the archaeologists were digging, and that's when archaeology was getting underway, and they found it. They found They found the palace, the ruin, the city, the walls, a huge library. It was all there. The prophecy was that you will be hidden. And for a while, for a time, Nineveh disappeared. That's like one of those, is it David Copperfield that hides big buildings? Or who was the, is that kind of a thing, you know? How did he do that? Oh, well, verse 12. All your strongholds are fig trees with ripened figs. If they are shaken, they fall into the mouth of the eater. Your strongholds are ripened fig. Now, the picture is, you know, the trees grow and the figs, they're just about to fall off. And so you go under the tree, open your mouth, kind of rattle a little bit, and it just drops right into your mouth. The strongholds, the fortresses. He's describing the fortresses being captured according to the Babylonian Chronicle. That's just the way it happened. Around 614 BC, the fortified towns, the strongholds, the fortresses that dotted around Nineveh began to fall. 13. Surely your people in your midst are women. The gates of your land are wide open for your enemies. Fire shall devour the bars of your gates. The prophecy here is of the gates being destroyed. Historian A.T. Olmsted, some of these books I was looking up on the internet, it's like reading Indiana Jones. A.T. Olmsted, he was born in the 1800s, and he writes around 1930, 1929. So it's just like Indiana Jones. So I was wondering if he's got a bullwhip, you know, and a big hat and the leather jacket. Oh, well, sorry. Indiana Jones writes, no. A.T. Olmsted wrote, the main attack was directed from the northwest, and the brunt fell upon the Hatami Gate at this corner. Within the gate are traces of the counter wall raised by the inhabitants of their last extremity. What he's describing is that the gates were being burned up, destroyed, and while this was happening, the people of Nineveh were frantically building another wall on the inside to cover up where the gate was, so that when they burned up the gate, that they would have another wall to face. That's the idea. Verse 14, draw your water for the siege, fortify your strongholds, go into the clay and tread the mortar, make strong the brick kiln. So he's prophesying that bricks would be made to re-fortify the city. Olmsted wrote, to the south of the gate, the moat is filled with fragments of stone and of mud bricks from the walls, heaped up when they were breached. In other words, as openings would come up in the walls, they would quickly fill them up with more bricks, just like Nahum is saying. Verse 15, the fire will devour you. The sword will cut you off. It will eat you up like a locust. Make yourself many like the locust. Make yourself many like the swarming locust. Now, the thing I want to focus on here, the fire will devour you, that there would be fire. And the city burnt. R.C. Thompson wrote, this guy's archaeology, there was no question about the clear traces of burning of the temple, for a layer of ash about 2 inches thick lay clearly defined in places on the southeast side about the level of the Sargon pavement. One of the historical things I read yesterday was talking about like the Great Library. The reason parts of the library survived was because a lot of his library was done on clay tablets. And so other parts of the library were done on wax tablets and others, you know, pieces of parchment, stuff like that. The parchment and the wax all burnt up, but the clay tablets baked. And so they all survived. So it's kind of fascinating the way this happened. But there was a fire, just like Nahum said there would be. Verse 16, you have multiplied your merchants more than the stars of heaven. The locust plunders and flies away. Your commanders are like swarming locusts, and your generals like great grasshoppers, which camp in the edge on a cold day. When the sun rises, they flee away, and the place where they are is not known. It talks about the generals, leaders being like great grasshoppers. The idea is that the officers would flee. The Babylonian Chronicle states that the army of Assyria deserted, that they ran away before the king. Verse 18, Your shepherds slumber, O king of Assyria. Your nobles rest in the dust. Your people are scattered on the mountains and no one gathers them. Your injury has no healing. Your wound is severe. All who hear news of you will clap their hands over you, for upon whom has not your wickedness passed continually? The last thing I want to point out of the prophetic aspect is that there would be complete destruction of Nineveh. History has shown that many cities, ancient cities in the Near East, were destroyed and would be later rebuilt, like Jerusalem, but not Nineveh. It was never rebuilt. Never rebuilt. Now, I've got 2 points I want to make before we have communion. 2 lessons. The first lesson is this. When you think of these 2 chapters, think about God's amazing word. When God promises something, it happens. I think Nahum is kind of accurate in predicting things 40 years before they happened. 40 years before they happened. I don't know if you kept track. I counted 12 things, and I actually left some stuff out of my notes because there's just too much to talk about. I counted 12 things that were listed specifically. Some of them even seemed contradictory, and yet they happened still. Friends, the Bible is filled with hundreds of prophecies that have been made and fulfilled. That is one of the reasons, friends, why this book is unique. I remember in high school, a friend who later actually became a Christian, I believe, but he used to say, one of his things when we would debate in our English class, he would talk about, well, you know, the Bible is just made up by a bunch of guys that got together in a back room somewhere and they made up all these stories because they wanted to figure out how to control people and make them give to the church. And that's, you know, you come up with all these kind of goofy ideas. It's just a man-made book. Friends, if you do your homework, you can't say that. The Bible is filled with hundreds of prophecies, just like Nahum, specific things laid out. And then, sometimes hundreds, sometimes 1,000 years later, it happens just the way God said. Quite a few years back, 50, 60 years ago, a fellow named Peter Stoner wrote a book called Science Speaks, where he applied the science of probability to the prophecies concerning Jesus. At the beginning of his book, he starts with just 8 of the prophecies concerning and looked into the probability that these 8 prophecies could be fulfilled by one man. And so he kind of went through each of the things, and I'm not going to even go through the 8 prophecies. If you download the notes, I actually listed these 8 prophecies. But his conclusion that the odds of any person that might have lived down to the present time fulfilling all 8 of these prophecies, his conclusion is that the odds are that it's 1 in 10 to the 17th power. That's the odds of one person from all history fulfilling these 8 prophecies. And what does that mean? That's a 1 with 17 zeros on it. So that's the odds. By the way, if this were the odds to win the lottery, how many of you would buy a ticket? Yeah. Of course, it's almost that much, but it's... No. To grasp the size of this number, Stoner talks about taking 10 to the 17th silver dollars. That happens to be about enough to cover the state of Texas 2 feet deep. Has anybody in here driven across Texas? God bless you. How many years did it take you to drive across Texas?
It just like seemed like forever, didn't it? It goes on and on and on.
We think California's a big state. California, Texas. Yeah, everything's bigger in Texas, that's right. Well, if you cover the entire state of Texas 2 feet deep in silver dollars, you come up with roughly that many silver dollars, 1 with 17 zeros on it. So to find out the odds, what the odds are about, so you take a silver dollar, and you mark one of them. One, only one, of the silver dollars that's covering Texas 2 feet deep. You mark it, and you stick it in the pile, and you stir the pile. Then you take a man, and you blindfold him. I picked a small man only because then it's easier for him to reach into 2 feet of the silver dollars. And you set him loose in Texas. And you say, you can wander as far and as long as you want. And you stay blindfolded. Just stay blindfolded. You can wander as far as you want. And when you're ready, reach down and grab a silver dollar. Now, the odds of him picking the one that's marked out of all of the silver dollars 2 feet deep in Texas, that's the odds of one person fulfilling eight of the prophecies of Jesus. Just eight of them. Friends, there were over 300 prophecies about Jesus in his first coming. Over 300 prophecies. I don't know about you, but every time I think about this, and I'm sorry if I don't mean to belittle anybody, but if you don't think Jesus is for real, you're an idiot. I mean, how can you come to any other conclusion? He is who he says he is. He can be no other. And so when Jesus himself says, I am the way, the truth, and the life, no one comes to the Father except through me. Now, I know some people have said, well, that's very narrow-minded. What about this, or what about that, or what about this religion and that religion? How could Jesus be so narrow-minded? Well, you know what? He's earned the right to be narrow-minded because he is unique. He is God in the flesh. He fulfilled these prophecies. Well, maybe he, like, had a checklist and went out and, like, checked them off, you know. So how are you gonna get born in Bethlehem? How do you get that one done? How are you gonna work out being betrayed by a friend for 30 pieces of silver? How are you gonna engineer that one? You're gonna have problems if you look into the reality of what Jesus did, what he fulfilled. You need to pay attention to Jesus. If you haven't given him your heart yet, you need to pay attention. This is someone special. And what we're reading in Nahum is just a taste of the amazing God that we serve. He can predict. It's not like, well, what like the National Enquirer, you know, where every year they have the predictions, you know. Have you ever followed up to see which of these predictions actually happen? Like, nothing ever happens. Unless it's like, on Wednesday, the sun's going to come up. Well, maybe that one will happen, you know. You look into Jesus, he's unique. Second point and last thing I want to close with this is this. The point is, God is for me. And I don't mean just me, I mean you too. In fact, why don't you say this with me? God is for me. Why don't you say this? God is for me. It's not against you. Let's say it again. God is for me. The whole point of Nahum is to encourage the Jews that God's going to take care of it. What are we going to do with the big bad Assyrians who are bigger than anyone else? They can do whatever they want. What are we going to do with them? You know what? God says, I got this. I got this. Because God is for them. Nineveh was judged because they had messed with God's people. And friend, if you have Jesus in your life, God is on your side. He is not against you. There was a time when the prophet Elisha was kind of like public enemy number one for the kingdom of Syria. Not Assyria, but Syria. That's modern Damascus. The Syrians knew that Elisha had this thing where he was like feeding the king of Israel like military intelligence, because like God would whisper in his ear and he would say, King of Israel, come here, I gotta tell you, you know, next Tuesday at 9 o'clock the Syrians are gonna attack over that city over there, so maybe you send some guys over there and take care of it. And so they would go send their army there. And when the Syrians would show up, it's like, where'd these guys come from? And like ruin all their fun. And so they decided, when they found out about this, they decided, well, we've got to take care of Elisha. So they actually sent an army to get Elisha. Because, I mean, that's smart, right? Get rid of the guy who's given the intelligence, right? Get rid of him. So one morning, Elisha's servant gets up, you know, makes his coffee, and goes out to get the newspaper. And he's rubbing his eyes and stretching, and he goes out the front door, and they kind of live up on a hilltop. And he's stretching and looks out, and the whole hill is surrounded by the Syrian army. He was a little bit distressed over this. And he went to talk to Elisha. And Elisha answered, "Do not fear, for those who are with us are more than those who are with them." And Elisha prayed and said, "Lord, I pray, open his eyes that he may see." Then the Lord opened the eyes of the young man, and he saw, and behold, the mountain was full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha. You know, here's I like this picture. The Syrian army is down here. Here's God's army. You think you're all alone at times, and friends, you actually aren't. You actually aren't. When you're following Jesus, I got to tell you, God's on your side. He's not against you. I know things aren't going the way you want. But don't make the mistake of thinking that God's against you. He's not against you. Look at Romans chapter 8. Turn in your Bibles to Romans chapter 8. Look at Romans chapter 8. I want to look at a few verses, and this is where we end. Romans chapter 8, starting in verse 31. Romans 8, verse 31. Paul writes this, "What then shall we say to these things? If God is for us, who can be against us?" You know, David was praying this morning, the Creator God, the God who measures the heavens with the span of his hand. Now, either he takes a long time to measure all those light years with his hand, or else he's got really big hands. And I got to tell you, it's the latter. God has really big hands. And if God is on your side, who can be against you? Verse 32, "He who did not spare his own son, but delivered him up for us all, how shall he not with him also freely give us all things?" If God went to the point of loving you so much that he sent Jesus to die for you, this Jesus, this God in flesh, the Son of God, the prophesied one, and God sent him to die for you, you think if God went to that point that he's going to just stop? Verse 33, "Who shall bring a charge against God's elect? It is God who justifies." You know what? Satan's going to bring accusations against you. God's the one who cleared all the charges against you. When you opened your heart to Jesus and you said, "God, I need you," God cleared the table. He cleaned off the document. He erased the document of all the charges against you. Satan can accuse you all he wants, but God's forgiven you. Verse 34, "Who is he who condemns? It is Christ who died, and furthermore, who is also risen, who is even at the right hand of God, who also makes intercession for us. Who shall separate us from the love of God? Shall tribulation, distress?" Some of you are going through tribulation, difficulties. Some of you are going through distress right now. You're going through tough times. "Shall tribulation or distress or persecution, or famine, or nakedness, or peril, or sword? As it is written, for your sake we are killed all day long. We are accounted as sheep for the slaughter." Now, I never liked this verse because it doesn't fit. If God is for me, then there should be no problems in my life. And you know what? That's because you have to grow up a little bit to realize that part of, that this life is going to have trouble. And sometimes God allows trouble in your life for a reason. Sometimes it's for His sake. And I can't tell you why. And I would be an idiot to try to tell you why. But sometimes God will allow difficulty in your life. Has He stopped loving you? No, 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 no. He's the one who gave His Son for you. He's not giving up on you. He's not giving up on you. But sometimes there's difficulty, and then He says, yet in all these things, we are more than conquerors through Him who loved us. Doesn't mean you get rid of your problems, but being conquerors means you get through your problems. For I am persuaded that neither death nor life, nor angels, nor principalities, nor powers, nor things present, nor things to come, nor height, nor depth, nor any other created thing shall be able to separate us from the love of God, which is in Christ Jesus, our Lord. Nothing can separate you from Him. God is for you, beloved. You may have to change your way of thinking a little bit. Maybe you've been telling yourself that God's out to get me, or somebody else is out to get me. Well, I got news. Who cares if somebody else is out to get you? If God is for you, who can be against you? You will have trouble. But He's not going to stop loving you. Not even death can separate you from Him. We're going to have communion. And so if I could get the folks who are going to help with communion to come up, how about the rest of us? Let's spend a few minutes praying, asking God to work in our hearts and prepare us for spending time with Jesus, just us and Him.